Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Hello, and welcome to the Currency podcast. This is Ed Brophy. The war in Ukraine has shocked everyone and has caused scenes that we thought we would not witness again in Europe. But the combined aftershocks of this extremely dangerous conflict could prove catastrophic for some of the world's most vulnerable countries. Escalating food and fuel prices and increasingly fragile supply chains present a real and present danger to the lives of millions in Africa and elsewhere, and could usher in a devastating new era of debt and dependency. To discuss the implications of the war in Ukraine for Africa, I'm delighted to have on the podcast today David McNair, Executive Director of One, a global movement co-founded by Bono and other activists campaigning to end extreme poverty and preventable disease by 2030. David, welcome to the Currency Podcast.
Hi, Ed. It's great to be with you.
David, One Foundation has obviously been very focused on Africa, and that is the core kind of focus of the organisation, and it works on campaigns around ending extreme poverty and disease and wider campaigns around debt and dependency. What is your sense of how the war in Ukraine is now having immediate impacts on the work you do in Africa and at the position of African countries?
Well, I mean, this invasion of Ukraine is a watershed moment in geopolitics, and it's obviously having devastating effects on the people of Ukraine, and it's created a refugee crisis in Europe, which is heartbreaking. We tend to think about these global campaigns a bit like, as you've described, earthquakes that have multiple aftershocks, or in another way of thinking about it, like they're like dominoes that fall and each one knocks another one down. And we've been thinking a lot about the dominoes that are falling in the direction of Africa. Africa is a massive, diverse and dynamic continent, 1.2 billion people, the youngest population on the planet. But it also has the largest concentration of extreme poverty, particularly in Nigeria and DRC. It has a lot of vulnerability to climate change and a lot of instability, particularly in the Sahel. So, even before this war hit, there was a lot of kind of vulnerability there. And I think the first domino, in a sense, is the impact on food security. Mm-hmm. Russia has more agricultural land than all other European countries combined. And the Ukraine has a quarter of the world's black soil, which is particularly fertile. So these two countries are in many ways the breadbasket of the world. They supply a quarter of the world's barley, a third of the world's wheat, 70% of the world's sunflower oil. And most of those exports go through Odessa and other ports in the Black Sea that are now completely closed to commercial shipping. So that's the kind of global picture. But if you kind of zone in on Africa, there are also direct trading relationships with Africa in terms of core food commodities that are particularly important. So the two countries supply about half of Africa's wheat, and that dependency rises to about 70% for some countries, including Egypt, Sudan, Djibouti and Tanzania. And the dependency on sunflower oil is even higher in North Africa. But there's another domino falling here, which is that the prices for these commodities are set on international markets.
Yes.
And the disruption is inflating food prices on those international markets, which actually were already at their highest levels since the 1970s, in part because of the disruption caused by the COVID pandemic. So if you look at the cost of wheat contracts on international commodity exchanges, in early March, they were 80% higher than they were 6 months ago. The cost of maize is seeing similar rises. And this has a contagion effect because buyers on these markets, then shift to other commodities and that drives up other prices. So if you look at sunflower oil, which, might not seem that significant, although it is, a core commodity for cooking in North Africa. But because the price is shooting up, because, Ukraine is the largest exporter, buyers are now shifting to purchasing palm oil. And palm oil is a staple in West Africa for cooking.
Yes.
So that's driving up the prices there. So it's just, each domino falls and knocks another one down. And, because of the vulnerabilities in Africa, I think we could be seeing, major increases in hunger and food security, which were already, at very, very high levels.
This issue of the kind of the dominoes falling and the cascading effects of the conflict, I suppose, are bound also by the time. So we have no idea at the moment sitting here today for how long this shock will continue and this conflict will continue. And I suppose what I'm really struck by things I've read from One before and things you've written before is the kind of, you know, limited amount of time that certain African countries would have in terms of stocks of these core kind of staple food commodities. Are there any countries that are really, really, you know, under pressure and really do not have much time? And then I suppose the linked question to that is, what are the alternatives? I mean, you spoke about palm oil as a substitute for sunflower oil, but I mean, where would African countries that are dependent on Russian and Ukrainian wheat get their wheat from or source it in circumstances where this was a conflict that went on for, you know, a very long time?
Well, on the plus side, you know, the way that the harvests work, most of the wheat is exported in the autumn, although maize exports continue through spring. So, I mean, if you look at Egypt, which, you know, is particularly dependent on Russia and Ukraine, I think they've got supplies on, you know, running until June. Mm. But, you know, if you're thinking about, you know, alternative producers, I think, you know, the US is obviously one. You know, I mean, there's a lot of agricultural and arable land in Africa, but here lies another domino falling, which is that Russia exports 20% of the world's potash, which is a key ingredient in nitrate fertilizer, and Russia's, you know, put a ban on those exports. So even if you wanted to scale up planting and you know, additional, you know, wheat planting or other commodities, and Europe has space to do that as well, but the supply of fertilizer will be another issue, which will have knock-on effects on costs.
So what you're, you know, what is happening is because of the conflict, the impact on supply that's having, and then also the effect of sanctions, both sanctions on Russia by the West, which is part of the kind of economic war the West is fighting against Russia, but also Russia, Russia's kind of counter sanctions against the West, which is effectively in the shape of export bans of key commodities.
Yep.
The countries who are on the front line of the fallout from that and the damage from that are not necessarily Western countries in the first instance, but they're African countries who are not in any way participating or taking sides to a large extent in the conflict in Ukraine.
Yeah, African countries and also, I mean, the Middle East is heavily dependent on wheat and other commodities from Ukraine and Russia, and that kind of brings another dimension to the conflict, which is that, you know, this is obviously creating a refugee crisis in Europe on a massive scale, but there were already, you know, humanitarian crises, Syria, Afghanistan, you know, Ethiopia, and the World Food Programme, which buys a large proportion of its wheat from Ukraine, will need to find other sources, and those other sources will be more expensive. So even for, you know, other crises that already existed before this situation exacerbates those.
And so while the eyes of the world are rightly on the humanitarian crisis and the refugee crisis that is developing apace in Europe, the eyes of the world and the attention may not be focused on the very real needs that are there in Africa and the Middle East. And that may also become a question of resources, where the resources that are devoted to dealing with the humanitarian emergency in Europe may be diverting some resources away from similar needs within Africa and other developing countries.
Well, there's two dimensions to this. So the first is that Ukraine itself is eligible for aid under OECD rules, and there will obviously be, you know, massive need for aid to that country and, you know, reconstruction efforts and so on. So that could be, you know, that money could be diverted from existing spending in Africa. But the other dimension is what are called in-country refugee costs, which under, again, OECD rules can be counted as aid. And during the Syrian refugee crisis in 2015, 2016, those costs doubled. So it increased to about, you know, $10 billion, which all of which was counted under existing aid spending. So that put pressure on aid to other countries. Now, if you look at the scale of this crisis, there's a think tank based in Washington called the Center for Global Development that has estimated that the annual cost of serving those refugees in Europe is about $30 billion, and that is the same amount of money as the total bilateral aid to Africa. So there could be, you know, unless European and other donors, you know, see the risks in Africa and put additional money into their aid budgets, you could see, you know, major pressure on that.
And of course, the other dimension here is the dimension of political instability. We know from the kind of Arab Spring and the Syrian civil war and all the way back to the French Revolution that, you know, the price of food and, you know, supply of food and difficulties around that can be a key trigger for political and social unrest, leading to enormous political instability. From where you're sitting, David, and where the One Foundation is looking at this, do you see an increase in political instability and, you know, political tensions in Africa, you know, as a kind of a, you know, direct line across from these food security shocks we're seeing at the moment?
I think that's certainly a risk. And you know, if you look at the example of the Arab Spring and, you know, situation in the Middle East and in North Africa, the cost of living was a kind of major problem. Now, even before this conflict, I mean, in January, there were protests in Morocco because of the cost of fuel and the cost of food. But also in the Sahel region, you know, you've seen in the last year, you know, coups in Burkina Faso, Chad, Guinea, Sudan, Mali. So the stability, I think, has already been affected in part by, you know, bad governance and, you know, nefarious actors, including, by the way, the Wagner Group, which has been described as the private army of Vladimir Putin, which is using its, you know, it is, you know, trying to expand Russia's influence in the region. But also just, you know, the fact that, you know, cost of living is going up and has gone up as a result of the pandemic. And that's, you know, affecting, you know, stability, you know, the confidence in governments. And a lot of African governments, you know, just don't have the fiscal space to respond to this in a kind of economic sense. I mean, you know, the smart thing to do if you had the space would be to, you know, introduce food subsidies, you know, social protection, you know, give families, you know, a bit of space to respond to the increasing prices. But if you look at the debt situation and the fiscal situation of African countries, 40% of those countries are in or at high risk of debt distress, according to the IMF. So they just don't have the space to do that. And the depressing thing, I was speaking to someone at the United Nations this week in New York, the depressing thing is that their operating theory is that some African countries, because they don't have that economic tool in their toolbox, will resort to a military response to quell protests. And that, you know, could mean more violence, which is very, very depressing.
Which is another domino falling in this chain. And I mean, on you know, this issue of debt and government financing, I mean, I think is very real. As you say, there's in one sense an inability to intervene to deal with the kind of food security and food price inflation shocks that African countries are witnessing and will witness. But in addition, there are blockages on you know, IMF support and things like that coming through as well. I was very struck by a point you made that one of the fallouts from the sanctions will mean that because of the reserve needs of European central banks, which will increase, that will actually make them less willing to share special IMF support, which is called special drawing rights, which is quite a technical phrase, quite a technical term. But I think it's a very real one for countries in Africa. Would you be able to expand a little bit on the kind of link between those two points?
Yeah, and this kind of get quite technical, so stick with me. But basically, during the pandemic, for a lot of low and middle income countries, the economic effects of the pandemic were actually worse than the direct health impacts. And you know, in 2020, that meant, you know, a fall in remittances from, you know, migrants in richer countries. You know, the oil price fell. You know, there was a lot of pressure because of lockdowns and so on. So the response from rich countries was relatively meager. They put in place a debt suspension initiative, which was not debt cancellation or even, you know, restructuring debt. It was basically pausing the interest payments that low-income countries would have to pay. That has now expired. So the kind of breathing space that created is no longer there. And those payments that were paused still have to be paid later. So that's on the kind of debt side. And the fear is that because of inflation, particularly in the United States. Most of that debt is denominated in US dollars.
Right.
So if the Fed increases the rates, that could both devalue local currencies, which would increase payments, but also could mean that future debt contracts are just more costly. Mm-hmm. So that's on the debt front. One kind of bright spot that occurred last year was that the IMF, the International Monetary Funds Board, agreed to create $650 billion worth of what are called special drawing rights. Mm. Now, this is a IMF reserve asset, which is you know, it's a bit like, you know, a central bank, like the European Central Bank or the Federal Reserve printing money.
Yeah.
It's a mechanism that was created in the 60s exactly for, you know, financial crises to help stabilize the financial system and provide countries with liquidity when they needed it. So that happened in August. Because of IMF rules, those special drawing rights or SDRs are allocated to IMF members based on how many shares they have.
Yes.
So most of them went to G20 countries that don't, frankly, need them. Of the $650 billion, about 33, well, exactly 33 went to Africa. So that was, you know, that was a good thing. But part of what, you know, the One Campaign and other activists have been working on is to push European and North American countries to share their special drawing rights that they don't need to help African countries with the fallout from the pandemic. So Emmanuel Macron in May last year made a commitment that he would fight for 100 billion of those 650 billion to be shared. Mm-hmm. That has not yet happened. About 50 billion of them have been pledged. And actually this week there was, as part of the appropriation bill in the US, there was a kind of tussle between the Republicans and the Democrats on the US share, which is actually the largest share of the whole thing. So there was about 20 billion that was in that bill and was taken out at the last minute. That 100 billion target that Emmanuel Macron was pushing for is now, you know, not looking likely that it will happen. And at the same time, as you've said, you know, the reserve needs of European central banks will increase. So the risk is that, you know, both on the kind of political side and on the economic side, that something that was already kind of pledged and promised will not be delivered.
Yeah.
And that then, you know, everything you kind of talk about, kind of there's another domino falling. That then leads into a perception from Africa that it can't rely on the West because the West makes pledges and doesn't deliver.
Indeed.
And that's something that Cyril Ramaphosa, the South African president, made very, very clear at a summit that the EU hosted in Brussels with African leaders just a couple of weeks before the invasion of Ukraine.
Yes.
Where the EU made this massive pledge of $150 billion or euros of investment in Africa. And his response when he was asked about it, he said, like, listen, let's wait to see what happened because, you know, we've been promised vaccines, we've been promised, you know, climate finance, we've been promised, you know, lots of things in the past and they haven't been delivered. So this situation of African countries just feeling like they can't rely on the West is meaning that they're increasingly wanting to hedge their bets. And that's a very interesting and worrying thing when it comes to, you know, what could be a new Cold War emerging.
Yes.
And new alliances, you know, emerging on the geopolitical front, you know.
Yes, yes. And I mean, I suppose that the conclusion to draw from that is if the money wasn't delivered last year when Europe wasn't facing this, you know, catastrophic war, you know, the risks of it not being delivered this year are even more significant in circumstances where it's even more badly needed now in Africa. So you can entirely understand the skepticism of African leaders about the reliability or the credibility of Europe and the West in general as a supporter. And I think that plays into, as you say, the geopolitics of it. We've seen in recent weeks, particularly at the UN, vote condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the pressure on African countries to take sides. And interestingly, I think in the press reports in the West, the vote was kind of reported as 141 countries voting in favor of condemning Russia, 4 against, and 35 abstaining. But I think, as Adam Tooze pointed out in a recent edition of his Sharpwood newsletter, which spotlighted some of your work, the numbers are deceptive because of the countries who were in each camp. Though the motion to condemn Russia had an overwhelming majority, weighed by population, the vote looked very different. Of the 7.7 billion people represented by governments taking part in the vote, only 42% were from countries approving the motion condemning Russia. Governments representing 51% of the world's population, in other words, a majority of the world's population, abstained, and half of the states which did abstain were in Africa. And I just wonder about that issue, because I think it speaks volumes to, I guess, the Western coverage and focus of geopolitics, but also of a very real dynamic within African countries and African governments, that taking sides actually is probably not in their national interest or in the interest of their citizens. And how that would then play out in terms of, as you say, the potential new Cold War that may be developing as part of this conflict.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. And that list, I mean, half of the countries that, as you said, abstained were African. Mm. But the African countries that abstained, you know, they weren't just the kind of, you know, poorly governed or kind of autocratic states. It mm-hmm. included Senegal,
South Africa. Yeah.
And I think that sense of, I think there are three operating theories here. Mm. The first is, as you've said, that, you know, African countries just don't feel like they can rely on the West, so they want to keep their options open. Mm-hmm. If they need, you know, economic support, or, you know, they need, you know, frankly, military support from Russia. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, I think part of that operating theory is that Russia will need friends on the world stage, and that could create opportunities for some African countries. Mm-hmm. The second operating theory is just that the I think the kind of posture of African leaders is that, you know, there's a renewed self-confidence, but also a kind of desire for strategic autonomy, in a sense.
Yes.
You know, they don't want to be kind of pawns in other people's game. They want to, you know, they've got their own plan, which is called Agenda 2063, which is a really kind of ambitious strategy for really placing Africa on the kind of global stage.
Yes.
You know, major investments in infrastructure, a kind of a pan-African trade area similar to the EU. Mm. Like, that's where their focus lies, and they've got a lot of other problems to deal with without kind of getting pulled into conflicts in other regions. And the third operating theory is China.
Yes.
So China is a major influential player in Africa, in part because of how much it has lent to major infrastructure projects in the past decade. And I think a lot of African countries, and, you know, certainly folks that I've spoken to, really have their eyes open in terms of, you know, they know that China has an agenda. They also know that Europe has an agenda and has a kind of track record of not delivering. Mm. They feel that the US has really kind of forgotten Africa and not really done anything meaningful in recent years. So if you think about that, you know, they've got their own problems, they've got their own vulnerabilities, and they've also got this, you know, increasing pressure and major debt to China, which in some cases, you know, those debt contracts are, you know, not particularly transparent. But there was a fascinating study done by a group called Aid Data, mm-hmm. which got hold of 100 of those contracts and looked into the detail of them. And some of them were quite, defaulting on the debt was contractually associated with breaking of diplomatic relations with China. So,
wow.
So there are some cases where, you know, the risks are kind of quite serious.
Yes.
There are other cases where the perception is that actually China listens and China responds and provides finance quickly for needs that, you know, are pretty urgent. One anecdote that I came across was, you know, one African leader who said to someone that I know, you know, in the time that he can sign a contract with the EU or the World Bank to build a road, China will have built the road.
Yes.
And in a context of electoral cycles, you know, a burgeoning youth population, the need for jobs and infrastructure, that kind of speed and responsiveness really, really matters.
Another anecdote.
Another anecdote relates back to the special drawing rights issue.
Yes.
Which is, you know, I had mentioned that Emmanuel Macron made this pledge in May last year that still hasn't been delivered. In the lead up to a summit in December last year, the Forum on China and Africa, Macky Sall, who was chair of the co-chair of that summit with President Xi, at the start of the weekend before the summit, made a request that China share 25% of its SDRs. And on the Monday, it was in Xi's speech.
My goodness.
So you know, that kind of speed and responsiveness
is
really striking.
It is very striking. And I guess, you know, there is this sense in the West that, you know, China is playing the game by different rules. And the anecdotes that you and just, you know, what we've seen in terms of Africa's greater involvement China's greater involvement in Africa, you know, testifies very significantly to that. But I suppose the other point, you know, there is that this is not altruistic on China's part. I mean, China is playing by different rules. One would assume, in order to, you know, leverage greater political influence within the African continent. And deploy that, you know, in China's geopolitical interests. And I guess what is also happening, and probably has been less visible in the West, is that Russia has equally been expanding its military support to Africa. I mean, we obviously saw Russia's involvement in the Syrian civil war. But again, in something that Adam Tooze wrote recently, he pointed this out, and he said that it's been expanding its Russia's been expanding its military support in Libya, Central African Republic, and Mozambique, and then obviously with the role of the Wagner Group, the Russian mercenaries in Mali, and you know, this is happening kind of quietly and really away from the West's attention. But I think that raises a concern, which is if the effect of the kind of economic war that the West is waging against Russia now and the isolation, economic isolation of Russia, is to drive Russia more into the hands or the sphere of influence of China in circumstances where both China and Russia are significantly expanding their role, both economic and military and political in Africa. That really places Africa in a position where it is potentially a new kind of front in a new Cold War, and that is very problematic for African countries. And I wonder what your thoughts are on the kind of the geopolitical implications of that.
I mean, I think the scenario that you've suggested is entirely plausible, which is very worrying when you think about, you know, democracy and human rights and all of the things that, you know, we hold so dear and kind of, you know, promote in the West. I think that you started out your kind of description talking about, you know, the fact that China has its own, you know, geopolitical and, you know, economic interests in its investments in Africa. Mm-hmm. I think the African perception, certainly from folks that I've spoken to, is that exactly the same applies in the US and Europe.
Yes.
So if you look at, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric in Europe about, you know, a new partnership of equals and kind of common values and so on. But if you look at the data, 65% or roughly 65% of European exports to Africa are manufactured goods. Mm. And the reverse is true when you look at African exports to Europe. 65% are raw materials, and most of that is energy.
Yes.
So in a context where Africa's priority is job creation, industrialization, and you know, addressing, you know, poverty and inequality, the perception is that, you know, despite the rhetoric, like, things haven't really changed with Europe. So there's that, you know, the kind of eyes open point that it's not that Africans see China is particularly nefarious. They see everyone as having their own interests, and actually they want to be on the world stage, respected, you know, promoting their own interests as well, you know. They want to be at the table rather than, you know, kind of, you know, seen as a kind of recipient of charity. But when it comes to the kind of geopolitical fallout of it all, I think the risk is that the US and Europe are kind of asleep at the wheel on this stuff, and they just aren't, you know, they kind of believe their own hype in terms of what they're offering to Africa, and it's not, you know, it's not substantive,
mm-hmm.
Either in terms of volumes of investment or in terms of the respect that they offer to African leaders and how they want to be treated, not as a kind of recipient of aid, but as a equal partner, having a seat at the table, you know, having a stake in decision making.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really fascinating to see, you know, Macky Sall, who's now the chair of the African Union, made a speech at the AU summit in January. And the things that he was putting on the table were really, you know, quite fundamental structural reforms, like the way in which the credit rating agencies, you know, determine risk, and therefore, you know, how African countries pay a premium in access to capital and capital markets. And so, you know, they're not asking for like a little bit more aid to help them respond to food crises.
Mm-hmm.
They want like a seat at the, you know, another seat at the G20. They want, you know, reform of the IMF and the World Bank. And actually, you know, they have every right to demand those things.
And I suppose what we're looking at now, if we are looking at a kind of a return to some kind of Cold War, or certainly, you know, a period of, you know, a chill in relations between Russia and the West and then China as well, is Africa becoming, you know, somewhat non-aligned between those two poles, and that probably being the issue that is, you know, are the approach or the path that is probably most in the interest of African countries, because I think in situations where the geopolitics is heating up and the rivalries between the West and Russia and China are increasing, I cannot imagine that it is something that will be in the interest of African countries to be necessarily taking sides in that struggle, and to be, you know, probably pursuing a path of non-alignment. But really, ultimately, I wonder how realistic that is, and will this come to a situation where African countries ultimately have to take sides and you know, identify with one block or the other? Is that something that is kind of a homogenous approach within Africa, or is that something that different countries will have different perspectives on that?
Well, I think one of the positive things over the last, you know, 5 years has been both a renewed self-confidence, but also African leaders increasingly speaking with one voice.
Right.
You know, on the pandemic response, on their kind of ambitions when it comes to, you know, the Pan-African free trade area and, you know, what they want from global institutions.
Mm-hmm.
I think the risk is that, you know, that increasing pressure could fragment that unity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, particularly if you look at China, China tends to deal on a bilateral basis with individual countries, particularly when it comes to their debt contracts and all of those kind of financial relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You could imagine Russia doing the same thing, you know, supporting autocratic leaders and trying to kind of build their influence in particular spheres or regions of Africa. And then that undermining the Pan-African you know, ambitions around Agenda 2063, which is their, you know, big plan for Africa becoming a player on the global stage.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the other thing that, you know, is easy to forget here is that, you know, amidst all of these kind of geopolitical discussions and kind of, you know, battles for power, is a young population, which is, I mean, the youngest population in the world, you know, lots of dynamism, ideas, creativity, but also, you know, they're kind of increasingly fed up with their geriatric leaders.
Yes.
And I think that could go one of two ways. It's almost like a bit of a fork in the road.
Mm.
You know, if they have the opportunities, the skills, the kind of connectivity with the global economy, that youth population could become, you know, a dynamic force in the global economy. But if they don't have opportunities, you know, they're increasingly frustrated. That could lead to a lot of instability, and that, you know, that's what you're seeing in the Sahel region and in the north of Nigeria. So I think the smart thing for Europe and North America to do would be to realize that actually this is a geopolitical issue. This is also, you know, a kind of existential issue for Europe, because you know, the African continent is at its closest point 14 kilometers from Europe.
Yes.
And so if you're worried about, you know, unmanaged migration, if you're worried about, you know, addressing climate change, if you're worried about the aging issues, which are, you know, quite significant in Europe, and all the kind of fiscal pressure that that will put on European governments in terms of funding pensions and so on, like a partnership with a dynamic, stable, prosperous Africa makes a huge amount of sense.
Yes.
But you need to invest now, because it could go in the other direction.
And yet it is an opportunity that that European leaders do not appear to be willing to take. And I think while the West is kind of somewhat asleep in relation to Africa and, you know, building that relationship and building it in a different way, you know, through the kind of lens of Africa as a dynamic region which has enormous growth potential and enormous innovation and enormous opportunity at its heart. You know, China, I think, is playing a longer game. And you mentioned the kind of younger people in Africa. I mean, you know, it's not beyond, I guess, the imagination that increasingly they identify more with the, you know, Chinese approach, or with, you know, China as a civilization, or as a kind of a form of governance or a form of ideology than they do with the Western ideology, because they just see the benefits flowing from the Chinese relation, albeit that they are, you know, entirely in China's kind of strategic interest, but at the same time they deliver benefits to the young African population and to African countries in general that just are just not forthcoming from the West. And I think that is a real, you know, very, very live concern, because I think the other thing China does is it plays the card of not being imperialist. You know, it doesn't have any imperial baggage in the same way that Western countries do, all of whom were former, most of whom were former colonizers in Africa. And China is able to, you know, play this card of it almost being a developing country that is now a middle-income country and will soon be a rich country. And it shows a kind of a development path for African countries that is very distinctive and very different from, you know, the path that the West would have pursued, where it, you know, became rich in part by exploiting African countries through colonialism and imperialism.
Yeah, I think that narrative could take hold. And it is in part, you know, a little bit disingenuous, because, you know, China is exploiting Africa's natural resources for that development. But I think, you know, that's a major risk. And I think one of the kind of really smart things that the European Union did was to invest in the Erasmus program and invest in those kind of relationships with, you know, young African elites that could come to Europe and kind of feel connected to Europe and so on. But China's doing exactly the same thing.
Right.
And, you know, if you look at the proportion of students that now, you know, travel to China to study rather than to Europe or North America, it's, you know, that balance is shifting.
David, just to wrap up, and this has been an extremely enlightening conversation, and I think we have a tendency to kind of, you know, look at what's happening in our immediate neighbourhood and not see the wider world. And I think that's particularly the case in the kind of fog of war that has descended on us all now. What are the kind of key things that European governments, G20 governments, even the Irish government could do to really refocus the attention on the needs of Africa in circumstances where obviously the war in Ukraine and how it plays out will be the thing that will have the most political attention in the year ahead? And is there anything, you know, meaningful that you believe, or that the One Foundation believes, can be done in a way to kind of, you know, refocus attention on Africa, while also obviously, you know, having the main priority as the response to the war in Ukraine? What are the key things that you know, key impacts or key interventions that the West could make now to refocus attention on Africa's needs?
I think the smart thing for Europe to do would be to learn lessons from the pandemic, where, you know, Europe turned inwards, it monopolized vaccine contracts, and that wasn't smart from an epidemiological perspective. It also really undermined the trust of African leaders and European leaders. And I often think, you know, people remember or find out who their real friends are when they are in a crisis.
Yeah.
So, you know, if there is a food crisis, I think, you know, first of all, doing the kind of logical things, which are, you know, not importing, imposing export bans on those kind of core commodities, because that will end up, you know, prices shooting up even higher. Second is, you know, really, you know, prioritizing African needs in terms of the economic response. And that means, you know, a serious attempt at addressing the debt sustainability issues, taking those special drawing rights, you know, even beyond the 100 billion and, you know, sharing them to help countries respond to not just the COVID pandemic, but also the effects of the Ukraine war and the aftershocks of it. And then thirdly is, and someone said this to me last week, their view was that the international response to COVID ended the day that Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine.
Yes.
And it's easy to forget that the COVID pandemic is still a pandemic. 86% of Africa's 1.2 billion population is not vaccinated. That is a risk for, you know, obviously, you know, vulnerabilities to the virus, but also the risk that new variants could emerge from Africa is pretty high, particularly where there are high, you know, proportions of the population living with HIV and AIDS. Where, you know, that is a immunocompromising condition. You know, the body can't fight the virus and therefore can live in the body longer.
We saw that with Omicron.
So I think, you know, a kind of rapid response to, you know, the economic effects, you know, share the 100 billion SDRs, go beyond that, you know, get to the World Health Organization's target of vaccinating 70% of the world population by September. And that's not just about sharing vaccines, it's also about investing in cold chain infrastructure and the kind of ability to roll those out.
Yes.
And then thirdly, I mean, a major priority of African leaders is, you know, their strategic autonomy when it comes to fighting, you know, viruses and pandemics. So they want to invest in their own manufacturing capabilities when it comes to vaccines. Europe is the single opposing force when it comes to an intellectual property waiver that has been proposed by South Africa and India. And that's, you know, that was the kind of major flashpoint at the recent EU AU summit. So I think the EU should change course on that. And actually, the main kind of opponent of that has been Germany,
right?
Which is understandable given, you know,
the proportion of vaccine.
Well, also the proportion of pharmaceutical
industry
that makes up makes up Germany's GDP. But we've seen in the past 2 weeks Germany do a kind of complete 180 on fiscal policy, on foreign policy.
Indeed.
And it's, you know, and it's chair of the G7. So I think there is a kind of an opportunity here to really show that, you know, the solidarity that has been and the unity that has been created within Europe because of the Ukraine crisis, you know, is not just about Ukraine, but it is about solving these other global issues. And when it comes to Ireland's role, I mean, I think we saw firsthand during the Brexit negotiations just how powerful Ireland can be in shaping the whole European agenda and indeed, you know, the US agenda as well, if it is focused and determined to do so. And I think, you know, Ireland, you know, choosing this as a, you know, an important issue, you know, and, you know, in a focused way, you know, shaping the European agenda and actually, you know, the space in the when it comes to, you know, international development issues, there's a real vacuum there now that the UK has left because it was a kind of a real champion of development effectiveness and quality and so on. So I think there is a massive opportunity for Ireland there on the European stage, but also at the Security Council and so on.
I mean, I suppose ultimately, you know, while we are experiencing this catastrophic event in Europe, our tendency is to focus on that and forget about the wider world. But I think it's very clear from the work you're doing, the work the One Foundation is doing and the work, you know, your partners in Africa are doing, is that Africa's problems are both Europe's problems and the world's problems as well. And there is no way around that without you know, the West, Europe, and, you know, the rest of the rich world taking these problems seriously. Whether it will or not is an open question, and we will have to see how that plays out. But David McNair, Executive Director of the One Foundation, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today, and thank you very much for appearing on the Currency Podcast.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.